Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and as of this past week, I believe all the WFYI podcasts are now available on Spotify, if you're into that. So go check that out. Joining me in studio to talk about the film critic's dilemma of the Midwest Film Journal is Evan Dossie. Hi, Evan.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Good to have you back here. So we mentioned the plight of the film critic because we have such hard lives discussing films. First off, you should never forget, you can pick what you want to watch first, and there are times. Well, I do that now after all these years, but there are some days it is like a job.
Oh yeah, yeah. Especially this time of year.
Yeah, this is our favorite time of the year because this is award screener time. This is when more movies are sent to us for award consideration. And no, we will never film the IFJA award discussions. We want to think it's Cannes in 68. It's not. It is far from it.
It's highlight of my year.
It's entertaining. I don't know if it's entertaining for an audience, but it's entertaining for us.
What we should really do is just record Richard Probst.
Yeah, that's true. The IFJA's doom and gloom critic there. That's our friend Richard, who has his own intro. We know it. But the other reason why we're talking about the plight of the film critic is because two of the films opening this week, neither one of us got to see. So it happens.
Yeah.
We have Ford versus Ferrari, and I know you can go to the Film Yap, and Chris Lloyd is heaping much praise upon the new James Bond-filled film with Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
Nick Rogers is his review for our site also heaping praise.
There you go. So anyway, you can check that out. And then they didn't screen Charlie's Angels for us, directed by Elizabeth Banks. So
I will note, speaking of sending us stuff, the studio sent Midwest Film Journal the 4K editions of the previous Charlie's Angels movies from 2 decades ago. Nick Rogers did a nice write-up of those. They didn't age well.
Even though they're in 4K?
Yeah.
Okay. And The Good Liar, that also not screened for us, but
no.
I don't think that's a reflection of the film itself.
Yeah, I was at a screener the other week with Sam Watermeyer, and that trailer goes up, and Sam turns to me and says, I didn't even know that was coming out. That looks awesome.
I know. So sometimes it happens. We're also Indianapolis, so sometimes we have to fight and scrounge to get to where we are today. So Evan and I have something in common because now we are starting to get knee deep in screeners because we have a meeting coming up in an undisclosed place in an undisclosed time. We're not telling you, but there is also stuff that is sent to us that has nothing to do with end of the year stuff, and we get distracted.
Oh yeah.
For instance, I did not ask for this, but I appreciate them sending it to me. I got the complete series of China Beach.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, which I never saw because I was in college. As much as I like looking at Dana and Marge, I never saw it in college, and now I'm watching it, and it's pretty decent.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. You, however, my friend, you hit the motherlode. You bought this on your own,
is this
what you were using to cleanse your palate from the award screeners?
Just to be clear, it's the Spine 1000 Criterion Collection Godzilla Showa era films. It says 15 films on the back. If you're a nerd like me, you know it's really 17 films.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the item I bought for myself and then told my wife and fellow critic, Allie, this is my Christmas and birthday gift from you this year. Don't worry about anything else.
Wow.
And
I'll have to work on that with Mrs. Soucy. Because I was saying earlier, At the beginning of the year, it was during one of the flash sales that either Criterion or that bookstore that should underwrite me, I got the Ingmar Bergman, basically the complete Ingmar Bergman filmography on Criterion. I've finished one page. I need to get cracking on that in the dead of winter. So, all right, let's break this down.
Yeah.
You have 17 films of Godzilla. Now, for those novices, or if, yes, we know Godzilla is an easy punchline. I mean, yeah, beautiful artwork, which is great for podcast. But a lot of, you have to remember that the first Godzilla film, this is the, and this particular one, I'm assuming that's on here, this is the Raymond Burless edition. This was, you know, the first Godzilla film was about, it's kind of symbolic of post-World War II Japan. And what, you know, what the country had to do to rebuild itself, and then, and you know, all the post bomb rebuilding and pollution and everything, and then, you know, a giant monster emerges.
Oh yeah, so the director of that first one, Ishihiro Honda, who's actually was best friends with Akira Kurosawa and helped direct most of his later films.
Ooh, very good.
He was a veteran. He was like a workman-like director for Toho Studios at the time, and this was a risky project for them. And they made the movie in 1954. American Studios, go ahead, buy it, strip out all of the subtext, throw in Raymond Burr for fun, release it in the United States.
And it's just a dumb monster movie.
Yeah, dumb monster movie. I consider them separate movies.
Oh, absolutely.
So, actually, both are included in this set. There's actually a separate Criterion release of those two movies that came out like 5 years ago, which I also bought.
So, I'm curious as far as the tone. So, what is taken out of the original cut?
So, the best example is there's a scene in the original Gojira movie after Godzilla's attack on Tokyo, where it's, you know, they have this sad music by Kira Fubi. I'm so sorry.
Pardon your Japanese. It's okay.
Yeah, anyway. And they show this ward of these dying people, and there's this little girl who's irradiated, and the scientist holds a Geiger counter up to her, and it reads that she's, you know, she's a goner. In the American cut, they take that scene, they throw it at the very beginning of the movie, and Raymond Burr just says out loud, like, ugh, people are dying.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's painting over the artistry with just blunt narration, which is actually what most of these Godzilla movies, they're American cuts that are the only cuts that were available over here for a long time. Almost all of them have some kind of narration as opposed to just, you know, presenting the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
So because I definitely am. I'm older than you are, but we are folks of a certain age that we know that there were many channels that would do like a Godzilla movie of the week, or we know the really, really cheap stuff or the knockoffs. And I always think this is a film. Godzilla has the kind of plague that the first Death Wish has, and the Rambo films have that. You know, the first film in and of itself is really good. It is the sequels that kind of stain the legacy of it. Now, what after Godzilla, what comes next?
Comes next is Godzilla Raids Again, which is one of those, you know, short turnaround sequels. No similar director, no similar actors. Doesn't really connect to the first one. It's just kind of a cash-in sequel.
It's a Django disease.
Yeah, what's funny about Godzilla Raids Again is that because the Suitmation was still early, they filmed the battle sequence incorrectly. So the only way they could show it is sped up. So if you can, watch the fight scenes
on
YouTube. Is
it Boots Randolph playing underneath?
You might as well be. It's pretty funny to watch. It's cool that they included it in this set because that's one of the ones that was very hard to find over here.
And had you seen that one before?
Well, I'll be honest. I've seen all of them before, just through extra legal means. But you know, I was glad I could
appreciate
buy them
that.
Here.
Okay, yeah. following that is...
You have the classic King Kong versus Godzilla. It's being remade next year.
Oh, jeez,
this set actually includes both the Japanese cut, which is very hard to find, and the American cut, which, again, cuts everything out and adds a bunch of narration.
Now, is there social commentary from here out at all, at least in the Japanese version?
So, getting into the weeds here, in the Japanese version of the next three or four movies, there is social commentary, all of which was cut out for those American cuts they would show on television.
Thanks, America.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
King Kong vs. Godzilla is, it's actually almost a fan film of the original King Kong film, because Toho desperately wanted to make a King Kong movie, which is actually how they ended up making Godzilla. Mm-hmm. So once they finally got to make their own King Kong character, it's all about an advertising executive who wants to boost ratings by kidnapping King Kong.
Now, and, is for those who didn't see, because we're on podcast, you did finger quotes, you did air quotes on King Kong. Does it look anything like the 1930s? No, Universal, if you dare to make anything look like the Universal monsters, you get letters from lawyers. So I wondered if they adjusted that.
It's hard to describe what he looks like. He looks like an approximation of a giant ape.
Okay.
So
fairly enough just to keep paperwork from not coming to the office.
Enough to call him King Kong, but not enough for anyone to get sued.
All right, very good. Yeah. And all right, how much screen time? That's the other one. I always think of, speaking of Universal, I believe it was Dracula versus Frankenstein. Might have been Frankenstein versus Wolfman.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they Bela Lugosi is the creature. Yeah, I'm that guy. And they are on screen together and they fight for about a minute, like in the last 5 minutes of the film. How much screen time does King Kong and Godzilla get in this
actually,
one?
More than you would think. I mean, you still make it through 45 minutes of the movie before either of them appear, but once you get past that halfway mark, they're pretty much in it for the duration. It gets a lot worse later on.
A lot of kids in short pants, like the Gamera films.
Yeah.
So I know Warner Brothers is making an expensive movie version of this. Over under on how much screen time those two to get together.
Man, I'm a little concerned. We were talking about how they didn't screen Charlie's Angels for us, and you get the sense that a studio is a little nervous about something. They haven't shown anyone anything, and King Kong vs. Godzilla 2020 comes out in 4 months. So
wait, they're releasing it in January?
February or March.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Supposedly.
So from a studio standpoint, they're going to balance out the Oscar contenders that are going to be, you know, plaguing theaters at that time.
Yeah.
That's still early.
Well, as an old fan like I'm a little nervous. But
that sounds like a summer release, but apparently it isn't. So
yeah.
Okay. All right. Next.
Yeah. So next, you get the crossover. Avengers-like crossover between Mothra and Godzilla.
Except it's not 3 hours long. Nine endings. All right, and how is that?
And it's actually really great. It's a sort of a retread. Now, this one is also directed by Honda, as was King Kong vs. Godzilla, and he'd direct a line of these movies, and all of them, you can tell it's the same guy who made the very first movie, because there's this social commentary. My favorite thing about the Mothra one is it starts with, you know, Mothra is a giant egg, turns into a larva, turns into a moth. There's an egg there, and the whole thing is this businessman wants to get land rights to own the egg. That's all he really wants to do.
Sure,
which is absurd, but also hilarious in that 60s monster movie way. That's a pretty great one, too. Godzilla's still clearly the villain. He's not the superhero in this movie.
But I would say, who is a bigger villain? Is it the monsters, or is it the Japanese businessmen?
I mean, that's up for debate.
Yep.
You
rank those. You know what? If Deadspin was still around, they would probably have made that list.
I feel like there's a market for that.
There could be. Well,
use my knowledge on the
Or you
journal.
Use it. There's a new thing at the journal. Earlier this year, I got a Blu-ray of the first Mothra.
Yeah,
and it's a good solid little picture.
It is good. Yeah,
as he said, it has the three stages. So for you science nerds out there that's into cinema, it follows that.
And it's interesting how in this one, so it's a direct sequel to that movie. Only in this one, they offhandedly say, "Well, her little Paradise Island, it got nuked, so don't worry about it."
Oh, so it's like Natalie Portman in the what was it, the Avengers film where she wasn't involved?
Yeah,
we put her away.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, follow next picture on that.
Yeah, so the next two sort of go together. They're the first appearance of the three-headed dragon Ghidorah. The first one is Ghidorah, the three-headed dragon. Notably, the first one where the monsters talk to each other with a psychic interpreter, which is pretty great. It's a moment where the camp really starts to come through. You get a little caterpillar Mothra riding on the giant pterodactyl Rodan, shooting its webs. You got Godzilla basically saying, "I don't like humans. They cause trouble."
I'm sorry. I think of the three-headed knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It's where the funny stuff happens, and then the sequel is where you get the iconic Monster X and the monsters with the visors, the aliens with the visors.
Yes,
there's an undercurrent in all these movies where the alien races are almost always entirely pretty women. Sometimes the same pretty women, sometimes different pretty women, but always a little, you know, geared towards the young boy audience.
Or the old man audience.
You know, that's where it starts.
Sorry, it's true.
Yeah.
There's one of my common punchlines in common conversation is in Japan that costs extra.
Yeah.
So
you get a little farther into that.
Hi, welcome to old white guys on film sociology. Let's move on to the next picture there.
Yeah. So the next one is actually their attempt at making a second King Kong movie.
Okay.
Universal says, you know, it's 1966. We want those rights back. So they actually made the movie Ibra, Horror of the Deep, about a giant lobster.
Fred Schneider singing.
It's as lame as you would think it would be. It's a bunch of kids end up on an island that's essentially a Bond villain's hideout who are trying to destroy the world. And then a giant lobster attacks them. And then Godzilla happens to be sleeping in a cave, helps him out.
Just so happens.
Now, it was supposed to be King Kong, and you can tell.
How can you tell?
Because everything he does is what King Kong would do in these Toho movies. He gets struck by lightning and powered up, hits his chest, walks around like a person.
And like Gamera is friends to all children.
Yes. This is when that starts. Well after Gamera was friends to all children, now Godzilla becomes everyone's buddy.
Oh, this is great. We're
at the point now where it's all candy colored. And exciting, and Honda.
They start cranking these out.
Oh yeah, like once a year. Honda's gone. He's replaced by Jun Fukuda, whose style is more geared towards kids, and he makes Son of Godzilla, which is a movie.
Oh yeah,
Pillsbury Doughboy.
Yep. If you look this up, if you've not seen this, because he's teaching his son how to blow fire and rings, and
he hates his son.
Wow, there's a happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yeah.
insert dad jokes here.
Oh, yeah.
I remember there's a film still not on video because getting the rights for all the films will be a headache, but it's called It Came from Hollywood. And this was it was about kind of bad drive-in movies. It was in the early 80s, and there are segments with Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, Gilda Radner, and Cheech and Chong. And they talk about like everything from the Brain movies to the juvenile delinquent movies. There's a little bit where they talk about the monster movies. And there is a segment of the kid trying to blow fire. That was my first introduction to that character and that film.
Yeah.
But still better than Godzuki.
Yes. Yes. Still better than Godzuki. It's definitely this is definitely the point at which the Godzilla series just
takes a dip.
I mean, there's still some great movies, but it stops all semblance of social commentary out
stop
the window.
There. Okay.
Oh yeah. And then it's actually strangely enough, there's this one after Son of Godzilla, you get Godzilla's son, you know, it's another movie where a bunch of kids are stranded on an island, you know. There's weather changing.
Different kids, different island.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's basically the same. So after that, Honda comes back because the Godzilla series isn't doing as well. So Toho says, let's end it. So they do Destroy All Monsters. Every monster that they have made in the past comes back for this movie. And this is where you get, you know, it opens, it says Japan, 1999. And Quentin Tarantino is famous for positing that this whole series of movies, aside from the first one, takes place as an alternate reality where Japan won World War II.
Okay.
And, you know, caused peace on Earth. So you have Destroy All Monsters, which is, you know, it's the greatest hits. You got the hot women alien again. You got the three-headed dragon. You got Mothra, Rodan, Gorosaurus, Varan from this other Mysterians movie that Honda made back in the 50s. It's, you know, it doesn't have any social commentary, but it clearly is meant to be the last Godzilla movie, which, of course.
And how long did that last? Kind of like Jason, the final, Friday the 13th, the final chapter.
Hold on.
Hold on a second. I think. Okay. Well, this is the title credits to Destroy All Monsters. I think I'm confusing. It might be the green slime that has the god-awful ballad about saving the planet. That's probably not a part of the series. Anyway, here's Destroy All Monsters title credits. Okay, enough of that. Okay, so that's 1969, you said?
68.
68. So they're going to finish. How many films did we discuss now?
We're about halfway through.
Halfway through. So here we go. This is it. 1968. They're done. Yes. How many years before the next one?
1969. Honda comes back. All Monsters Attack, which is a clip show. So it's, it's basically a Godzilla clip show.
Yeah.
About a little kid who is kidnapped by a bunch of gangsters and goes into his mind where he's imagining being best friends with the son of Godzilla, which helps him gain the strength and wherewithal to escape his captors and beat up his bullies.
Oh, I think Svengoolie showed this Universal. Obviously, if you know Svengoolie, Saturday nights at 8 on MeTV. I'm actually wearing the shirt right now. But they have the Universal catalog. So anything that's Universal or Universal related, and that's one of them.
Yep. And it
not good.
It's hey, I enjoy it. And,
okay.
And funnily enough, Indianapolis connection. The end of the movie, he's beating up the bullies. One of the bullies has an Indy 500 shirt on.
Oh, that's great.
So
Toshiro Mifune brought it over from Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay, next.
So you get 2 years later, you get the Godzilla versus Hedorah, which is the classic smog monster.
Ah, known around here as Godzilla versus Smog Monster.
Yes. Okay. And that's actually the only movie of this series not directed by Honda or Fukunda. It's directed by Bano, who was banned from making Godzilla movies after this movie.
Because
it's an extremely surrealistic Godzilla movie.
Too heady for the kids?
Way too heady for the
trippy.
Kids. Okay. Too scary for the studio. Too violent. It's the only big monster movie where the big monsters legitimately kill people. You see people disintegrate and die. It's also known as the one where Godzilla flies by sticking his tail between his legs. And
oh, that's
fire.
A Mystery Science Theater image.
It is.
If you're fans of that show and the credit sequence. So we're not – they hadn't figured this out kind of like Man of Steel.
Yeah.
We're not going to think about all the buildings that are destroyed in the previous movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're all empty, of course.
Yeah, of course. I mean – you know, movies for kids, and they bring in Bano, and he's like, I have a vision. And, you know, he's banned from the series for life. So so they righted course. There are then two classics, and I know that the latter is on Mystery Science Theater, but the first is called Godzilla vs. Gigan, where he fights the giant cyborg chicken with the chainsaw stomach.
Yes, yes.
And after that comes Godzilla vs. Megalon, which I know had a Mystery Science Theater entry. It's the one where they had the there was a rights issue, so it became public domain in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one where he fights a giant beetle with drills for arms.
Yep.
And classic poster where it has the two of them on top of the two World Trade Centers.
Oh, jeez.
Which was their attempt at eating away at Dino De Laurentiis' King Kong.
King Kong. There you go. Yeah, season 2, episode 12.
Yeah.
Man. I may have to. Yeah, I'm sure I have this.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's 70. Yeah, 76. Okay, yep. So good at skewing on that.
So actually that's so after, you know, Gigan and Megalon come back, the studio is like, well, we got Godzilla where we want him, but he's still not doing as well. No more of that smog monster stuff. We're going to come up with a villain everyone will love. So they release Mechagodzilla.
And a South Park episode is born.
Right. So Mechagodzilla comes in. He's actually a lift off of both, you know, the fad in Japan that was starting with mechas and Mechani-Kong from one of their King Kong movies.
Right. There's a Metal Kong, I remember.
Yeah. So in this one, the aliens who are invading, who've created him, are created after cast-off Planet of the Apes masks.
Yep.
Called simians. And there's a big, like, fake, like, spy plot to lift off James Bond. There's a prophecy for this, like, warrior who's actually a giant dog monster named King Caesar. There's a pop song tie-in released to King Caesar.
There is.
It's like a full court press to try to save the Godzilla movies. And it's, incidentally, it's actually one of the rarest Godzilla movies to get in the United States until now on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the big deals with this release for Godzilla heads like myself.
Okay.
But Mechagodzilla does okay. So, you know, the studio's still not enthused about Godzilla, and they released the last movie on the set in 1975 called Terror of Mechagodzilla. Which,
this time it's personal.
Yeah. So this one, it's actually on the Midwest Film Journal back in May, I wrote up a series of letters to Godzilla called "Are You There, Godzilla? It's Me, Evan."
Yes, and read that, folks, please.
I didn't get to go through this whole series. Just I tried too much. Because
thanks, family.
Because this 16-17 movie set is only half of the totality of Godzilla.
Right.
It's the best part of it. Sort of like how Sean Connery is always going to be the best Bond.
Yes. Got it.
Hope that's not a hot take.
Nah, it's fine.
But Terror of Mechagodzilla is the only one written by a woman, and the Japanese cut has this surprisingly fascinating love story between a cyborg woman whose heart is tied to Mechagodzilla and her lover who has to try to help stop Mechagodzilla and the aliens who have put the time bomb in her heart.
Literally.
It is
That's
absurd.
A pop song lyric right there.
Oh yeah, it's absurd. It's silly, it's childlike, but it's, you know, it's beautiful in its own strange Godzilla-like way. But that one's a pleasure to revisit because it's known for being the one that killed Godzilla for 10 years.
Okay.
So.
And yeah, because I remember, it was about 86 when Godzilla made a return to mall theaters when I was a teenager and I didn't see it. That's it. So, yep. Okay. So we have a span. When was the first one made?
Yeah, so it's a span of 21 years.
21 years and 17 films. That's pretty impressive. So, and this is available on Criterion, as you said. This is number 1,000 in their collection. So, are there a lot of features on it? Because I'm that guy. I'm going to go through every single item that's available. I paid for it. Why not?
Oh yeah. So one of the coolest things is that, like the Bergman set or the Zatachi set. It comes with a series of essays, mostly written by Steve Reifel, who's a Godzilla historian.
Right.
He's written a lot of great books. He wrote a big book on Ishihiro Honda that's awesome. Mm-hmm. He has written new essays to sort of contextualize each movie. Each movie is accompanied. Obviously, podcast, hard radio show, hard to show the size of this book, but it's a coffee table sized collection.
Yeah. I think we'll take a picture and put it on.
It's a good idea because each movie has a piece of artwork by a famous comic book artist.
Okay.
And an essay by Steve Reifel explaining the context and the history of each movie. There are new HD re-releases of every movie. Although, interestingly enough, once again, sort of like Godzilla fan inside talk, there's actually 4K restorations that Toho would not allow Criterion to use.
Oh,
so these are actually the Blu-ray releases from the mid-2000s, still upscaled, still look great,
right?
Still available for the first time here, but
they're saving some.
They're saving something for a release that's only for Japan. So, I'm not going to import it. But.
So, we mentioned earlier the first Godzilla. Do the other films have the American run with alongside the Japanese run?
Yeah, unfortunately, not.
Okay,
but that's largely because a lot of those are owned by various distributors in the United States.
All right,
the rights issues are kind of difficult to find. They have dubs, which are in themselves hilarious.
Yes. So what it reminds me of, there's if you get a chance, folks. I mean, there's 5 different versions of the Blade Runner box set.
Yeah.
So you can get those versions as well as Criterion. Also, to put out the box set for Brazil, Terry Gilliam's film, where you have the original, the director's cut, and then the thing that Universal put out. Good Lord.
Yeah.
So I wondered about the many different cuts on that come with it.
Well, they have the Godzilla plus the Raymond Burr cut.
That's enough.
And then they have the King Kong versus Godzilla Universal American cut and the Japanese cut.
Okay.
Now, the Japanese cut isn't treated like a restoration. It's a special feature. So there are actually moments where you can tell that they're working from a print that was never perfected. So quality comes in and out. You can, when you're watching an archival cut. Yeah. But, it's still the best movie in the franchise.
All right. So if you had to pick 5 from this lot, what would you go with?
Well, King Kong versus Godzilla, the Japanese cut, indisputably the best of the goes without saying, the first Gojira, it's a class of its own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, King Kong versus Godzilla is hilarious and, the first time where Godzilla fights a beast WWE style, where they're picking each other up, throwing each other, smashing buildings.
Empty buildings, of course,
of course,
we mentioned.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes the villains are in the buildings.
Oh,
but,
okay,
never
that's
the
fine.
Good guys. keep that in mind. You know, King Kong versus Godzilla, Mothra versus Godzilla is wonderful. Invasion of the Astro Monster.
Okay.
Terror of Mechagodzilla. And I have a really, you know, the only Godzilla movie I owned, I actually went out and purchased a Blu-ray edition of, had some VHS tapes and stuff, but was Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, because it's uniquely absurd and surrealistic and poppy and odd. And in a lot of ways, this set is based off of the aesthetic of Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, being so like almost Andy Warhol-esque, like of the 60s and 70s, like colorful, surreal, strange.
How did you get interested in Godzilla to begin with? How young were you?
My cousin and I owned the VHS tapes that they re-released in the early 90s.
Okay.
Renting them from the library, renting them from, you know, Smog Monster gave me nightmares. I still have, like, you know, I can still remember being terrified watching them.
Wow.
Yeah. I've always loved Godzilla, so it was a lot of fun getting back into Godzilla, and then I hang out on the Criterion forums because, I mean, I just can't stop. You know, it's an addiction. And I got early word 3 years ago when they were starting to quietly pick up the rights to every Godzilla movie.
Yeah, because I remember when they released Godzilla on its own.
Yeah.
And it's just another reason why, and we're not paid or endorsed to do this, why Criterion is so good, because it runs the gamut. Yes, you can get Bergman and you can get Michael Bay films and you can get, you know, Louis Malle films, and you can get even, you know, and they even show Godzilla. It's fine film regardless of the genre. But, you know, but in this case, obviously, they talk about the social significance.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's a really nice package. It's very cool.
Yeah. It's really funny. They released this the same day they released John Sayles' Matewan.
I do love Matewan. Yeah. I need to get that. I believe there's a certain shop that's half off through the month of November, and I want to get Matewan.
And my wife and I do a Criterion sale tradition of every time there's a sale, we, you know, air quotes, buy each other a Criterion edition.
There was a flash sale, which I purchased, Local Hero, which I'm finally, I've said this more than once on the show, on behalf of Ed Johnsonot and myself, thank you for finally putting that out. Now, put out Tender Mercies, same year. No, but there was that, House, the Japanese film.
I love that movie.
My God, that's what I watched on Halloween. So if you've not heard last week's show, it's not even fair to call it a horror movie. It's a mind freak. It's a group of Japanese girls, teenagers, I'm guessing, who visit an auntie's old house. Now, it's about 20 minutes before they get to said title of the film. But it's the acting and the camera work is so heightened.
Yes.
It's really jarring.
And the music?
It's really frantic music. Once they get into the house, there are some spirits, and it just goes bat spit bonkers.
It's the best killer piano I've ever seen in a movie.
Yes, there's stuff like that. There's layers of... I you know, there's certain camera work, which was a big deal in 1977, of, you know, floating things and you could say early green screen, but it's truly bonkers.
That is one of the most surprising experiences I've ever had with the movie. Watching House for the first time.
And you're just like, what in the hell is this?
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it. So
I brought it to the FYFF Film Festival we do 1 year just to see, you know, Joe and Sam and Nick's reaction to it, because they had no idea.
Yep.
Like,
I had heard about it. I know Landmark or Keystone. Keystone showed it last year. I wish I had seen that. What a crowd.
Yeah, I wish I had too.
And the guys were gobsmacked?
Yeah, of course.
Nice.
But, you know, that's how we always are at those festivals.
That is true. So, yeah, I bought Local Hero, bought House, and then bought for my daughter, because she was interested in it, Clute. Which we still need to watch.
I just watched that for the first time like a
really?
Week ago.
Really? Yeah. What'd you think?
I loved it.
Uh-huh.
I've been slowly, it seems, going through a lot of Jane Fonda's earlier movies. And it was what you're talking about at the beginning of the show. I was tired of watching screeners, and I was like, I'm going to
cleanse your palate somehow.
Yeah, I'm going to get on the Criterion Channel. What's there? It was the first thing up there. I was like, well, I haven't seen that. Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's a really tight thriller of her and Donald Sutherland and Roy Scheider. Alan J. Pakula directs it.
Oh, yeah.
And she had already, she was an ingenue in the 60s, and you kind of heightened or capped off with Barbarella, thanks Roger Vadim. Then she kind of took a bigger grip of her career, got a nomination for They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And then this was the next step. And then she won Best Actress in 1971 for this. And then there was no turning back. So, I'm glad you got to see that finally.
Yeah, that's great.
Very good. So, all right. So if you don't mind me asking, would you guys buy each other?
Let me remind myself. So
you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here on WFYI.org. Evan Dossie and I talking about Criterion stuff that is we bought with our own money. So there.
Yes. So this time, Allie actually, because she was a Criterion Channel subscriber, she was one of the first subscribers. They sent her a gift card. So she got two movies this time.
Oh, how nice.
So she got herself a copy of Hitchcock's Notorious.
Ooh, which, I do have that.
Oh, yeah. We've been putting that off for a little while. She also got Only Angels Have Wings.
Oh, okay.
Which I'm excited to watch. I am still sitting on my pick this year. I'm waffling whether I feel guilty getting an extra one after buying this Godzilla set.
Don't be.
But I cannot decide. I have quite a few choices that are sitting in my head. Paris, Texas is one that I'm thinking about getting.
I have that.
But I've already collected a lot of their Errol Morris documentaries.
Yep.
So Thin Blue Line is one that I feel like I should buy at some point or another. And Matewan, which, you know.
I'm a big John Sayles freak. And if you get a chance, the John Sayles visits the Criterion Closet.
Yeah.
I actually texted Criterion and said that's my top of my fantasy birthday wish list because I turned 50 this year. They've not responded back. I think they get that a lot. So,
I imagine. You go to the bookstore, and it's almost like walking.
I'm actually hopefully next week I'm going to go in there, and I want to get Matewan. But since you brought up your lovely wife and your family.
Yeah.
So, how long did it take for you to get through the Godzilla box set? Because Evan's a new dad, and this is a particularly good challenge because kids don't care because babies don't care if you're watching Godzilla.
Well, I feel particularly blessed. My son, who's 8 months old as of this Monday, he's getting a good rhythm. He goes to sleep about 7:30. Allie goes to sleep about 8. Godzilla movie's only about 70 minutes long.
That's true.
You can knock two of them out before you go to bed. And he's playing on the floor, you know.
I've given Evan, for you new parents or parents to be out there, or older parents, whatever, but I've said this since day one because my daughter's 17. You can watch anything in the first year.
Yeah.
Anything in the first year. Emma is still yet to bring up the Wild Bunch, and I'm happy about that. So first year, it's just sounds and visions, and it's fine. You're going to be okay. But after that, then you might as well. But I'm usually the first one up. I mean, but I can. There were some mornings I could bang out a movie, sometimes two, before the smarter two-thirds wake up.
Yeah, I value my 2 hours of movie time.
Yep.
But I can fit anything I want in. But
so how long did it take?
I mean, only about 2 weeks.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I mean,
on top of family and work and the journal and other stuff getting in the way.
You think about it, they're. A lot of TV series now have episodes as long as an old Godzilla movie.
That's true.
So it's not too hard. Plus, I've seen them all before, a lot. So a lot of times it's the fun of just like revisiting this movie, that movie. Oh, this differs from the cut I watched last time. So it's easy to watch them through.
And how is your wife on Godzilla?
Well, she, let me tell you. So she loved the 2014 one. She loved this year's Godzilla King of the Monsters. Which is great because it's my I guess it's my dark horse nomination with the IFJA this year for several categories.
Oh, okay.
Not best picture, but
other things.
But she fell asleep. Okay, let me tell you a story.
Please.
I'm going to set the record straight.
Okay.
Have a couple's argument. She claims that she has seen the 1954 version of Godzilla, and that we watched it when we first started dating 5 years ago or so. I know for a fact she fell asleep. And she insists that she has seen it. She has not seen it. Similar thing happened when I tried to make her watch King Kong versus Godzilla on this most recent watch through. But in fairness, we do have a baby, and you know.
Yeah, that's kind of like I know the six films I watch to and from Scotland, and they sort of count, but it's just it's uncomfortable, and I was sleep tired, and I wasn't sleeping well. You're up, and I technically saw those films. I don't know if I could actually review them. So
I don't hold it against her. No. I mean, like a lot of movies on the Criterion Collection, you know, it's an acquired taste.
Right,
you got to get the Godzilla in early, or you may not, you know.
Oh, that's funny. So, congratulations on that. That's fantastic. I think you've inspired me that once award season is done, I gotta crank out some Bergman. So there is that. All right. Shifting gears just a little bit. Speaking of other stuff that's out on video recently. Here we go on Blu-ray and video. So I will throw these titles. And they all have something. I haven't seen any of these either. So we're really hitting you up with the hard titles, new titles, folks. The Peanut Butter Falcon.
Pretty good.
You laugh?
Yeah, Shia LaBeouf, when he's on, he's on.
You mean performance artist Shia LaBeouf?
Yes.
But this one he is.
Yeah, and it actually stars a young man, a young actor who has Down syndrome, playing a character who has Down syndrome.
It's like the two guys on the lamb.
It's a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn style story, but in contemporary America.
And who's that make? Dakota Johnson.
Dakota Johnson.
Fair
enough. She's not much for playing other characters.
Okay, that's fine. But
I will say, I did not realize this, but Joe Shearer did point out major wrestling connection. I'm so sorry I bring it up without remembering, but
keep going while I do some heavy clicking.
It's
here
the entire movie is about Shia LaBeouf helping the young runaway meet his wrestling idol and trainer. The trainer is played by Thomas Hayden Church.
Yes.
Once again,
Jake Roberts and Mick Foley. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Oh God, John Hawks is in this.
Yeah.
And Bruce Stern and John Bernthal. So. Okay, so I think here's your independent film of the week.
Yeah,
I think
it's pretty great. It's on a lot of top 10 lists, I think.
Okay, yeah. As the other film of note that comes out this week on video, The Farewell.
I didn't see that. We're going to get a screener of that for sure.
Okay,
it's pretty great.
So I can't wait to see that. And then Good Boys is out on Blu-ray.
Didn't get a chance to see that.
And Angry Birds 2. Moving on.
Yeah.
I don't know who asked for that. Probably the ones that like playing with fire, if you heard last week's show. That's kids' films here. A couple of old titles. Speaking of Criterion, The Day Trippers is now out on Blu-ray.
I've never gotten a chance to see that.
I think I've seen it, but I don't remember enough of it to actually form an opinion. I know that's wonderfully vague, but it's true. And then two older titles of note, because there's those video companies that kind of put out lesser known obscure. But if you need on Blu-ray, the Don Siegel directed Walter Matthau film Charlie Varick. There was a brief period where Walter Matthau in the early to mid 70s was sort of an action star because he was taking the film 1-2-3, The Laughing Policeman, and this. So it's actually very good. And then Road Games.
I've never.
The Australian thriller with Stacey Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis. It's basically Rear Window from a trucker's point of view.
Now, that's an elevator pitch if I've ever heard
it. It is. And it's one of those I highly recommend. There's a wonderful documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, which is about the Australian exploitation films or the Ozploitation films. And there's a section where they talk about a lot of Australian films sometimes to get outside money, to get international money, especially from England and from the States, you put in an American and an English star and you try to pass it off as a Hollywood film, even though it's shot in Australia. And that's basically what this was. It was shot in Australia, in the outback, on the highways, and sounds... Jamie Lee Curtis is adrift, is a hitchhiker. No hitchhikers look like Jamie Lee Curtis. And Stacy Keach is the truck driver who thinks he's witnessed a murder. So, but it was one of those that they, yeah, because you had Hollywood stars and it had a little disguise, and then oh, it's shot somewhere else. So anyway. Both solid titles if you need those on Blu-ray. The other thing I forgot to mention is because it's still in theaters and I'm glad it's getting more than a week. But Cyrano, My Love. Basically, if you take Shakespeare in Love and replace Romeo and Juliet with Cyrano de Bergerac, so
yeah, we had Lou Harry covered that for us over at Midwest Film Journal, and I do not know enough about theater, but I enjoyed reading his coverage of it.
Well, so, I mean, it does hit a few of the kind of the greatest hits, like the insult, the bars, the tavern scene with the insults, and the, you know, Cyrano's quote unquote balcony scene. So I think the more you that alone, and the same thing with Shakespeare in Love is, you know, the more you know about it, you really get a lot of the nooks and crannies. But overall, as a film, it's still pretty enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because it takes about 20 minutes for I griped about Joker because it borrowed from a 36-year-old film, and I'm like, well, this is basically Shakespeare in Love, but I'm actually liking it. Yeah. So once it got into Showtime, into the performance, I really did enjoy it.
That's great.
So, all right. I think I'm going to wrap things up a little bit. I'm sorry. I want to get to IU Cinema for those who are planning your road trips. So, by the way, movies are worth driving for. Saturday, November 16th at 4 o'clock, the WeTel Collaborative Knowledges. It happens at 4. At 7 o'clock, Cyborgs, Heroes Never Die from the Ukraine. Sunday, November 17th from 1940, Dance Girl Dance. And then at 4 o'clock from 2019, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Monday, the 18th, The Edge of Heaven at 7 p.m. Thursday, the 21st, We Tell Environments of Race and Place at 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 21st. And then Portrait of a Lady on Fire again, Friday, the 22nd. And then Saturday the 23rd at 4 o'clock, the 90th anniversary screening of The Wild Party at 4 p.m. and Vagabond from 1985 at 7 p.m. Also at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, Friday night, 2 and 7:30 p.m., because it's that time of year, 35mm print of Love Actually. So you don't have to watch it on cable.
It's that time of year.
Yeah, there is that time of the year. And then Sunday the 16th at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. on Saturday. I believe these are all Warner Brother cartoons, but cartoons for cans. So nice. Bring canned goods. That will help out. Interchurch Food Pantry. So that is happening there. And then Saturday, November 16th at 7:30 p.m., Lethal Weapon, the first.
Excellent.
Yep.
It's that time of year.
It is that time of year. 21st, or I'm sorry, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, Friday and Saturday at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Sunday at 2 and 5:30 p.m. If you're into Deadeye Animation, Robert Zemeckis' The Polar Express.
Deadeye Animation.
I didn't coin that, but it's kind of true. I actually didn't mind The Polar Express. So, all right. Before we wrap things up, Evan, what is happening at the Midwest Film Journal?
Sure. So in addition to our regular coverage of all new releases, we're starting up our last group writing project. We invite writers from other Indianapolis sites and other international sites to contribute essays around a theme. We do a horror one in October every year. We've done a Marvel one. We're doing a Star Wars one in December. We've got a couple other IFJA writers coming in. Everyone's writing about Star Wars in some way leading up to the new movie. We're really excited to launch that. We have like 19 essays that are going to post up about Star Wars and various, some quite unexpected directions for their essays.
Anybody doing The Hidden Fortress?
Nobody.
Also on Criterion.
Also on Criterion. No, there are people who will be touching on The Hidden Fortress in their essays. But we've got some pretty funny ones. And then next year, we're going to do another actor-focused. This past year, we did Gerard Butler's filmography with The Butler Did It.
Why would you do that?
And this year, we're doing Vin Diesel's filmography with All We Do Is Vin.
What is wrong with you guys? Are you, did you lose a bet with God?
You sound a lot like Allie right now.
I mean, with the exception of Find Me Guilty, why would you do that to yourself?
There's just
then again, says the guy who owns Blaxploitation. But
the man is prolific. He has a lot of depth.
He is Groot. he lives his life a quarter mile at a time.
Yeah, you know, he does. You know,
and he's not watching Dwayne Johnson movies.
He's We're going to see. We're going to find out why we're doing it in the process.
I'm the biggest guy around here. Oh, hi. Man, you're taller.
We joke, but I have a few surprising people who have jumped at the chance to write about Vin Diesel.
Okay, but that involves the non-franchise stuff. And, man, if you watch non-franchise, that's a rough patch.
It's going to feature Nick Rogers, co-founder of Midwest Film Journal, has actually seen all but two Vin Diesel movies, and he will be watching his final Vin Diesel movies for this project, including Babylon AD.
I was about to say, I suffered through Babylon AD. That's a rough...
He's refused to watch it until February.
Great. Well, good luck, Nick. Jeez.
Yeah, that's what we have going on.
All right. We're going to get to Dead People We Like. We're going to wrap things up with Dead People We Like because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. But if you are a film nerd in one way, shape, or form, it's one of these you don't know the name, but you know the image. Actress Virginia Leith passed away on November 4th at the age of 94. So actually, two footnotes of film notes. Her first film was playing the character of the girl in 1953's Fear and Desire, also known as Stanley Kubrick's directing debut.
Hmm.
So look for that, folks. I believe I have it in the Stanley Kubrick collection. Thank you, Warner Brothers. I bought it. Other titles, 1954's Black Widow, 1955's White Feather, 1955's Violent Saturday, On the Threshold of Space, A Kiss Before Dying, the original Kiss Before Dying, and Toward the Unknown, all from 1956. She has 26 credits to her career, including a lot of TV appearances in the 70s. She is best known for playing the character of Jan Compton, also known as Jan in the Pan, from 1962's The Brain That Wouldn't Die. And if you've ever... See, if you've seen the footage, and of course, at the moment, it's on my Facebook page. But this is also the first Mystery Science Theater episode with Mike Nelson at the helm. This is the film they watch, and it's basically a scientist whose fiance is decapitated, and he's going to keep her alive by putting her head in a pan. Or in this case, somebody cut a hole in a table so the actress can put her head through the pan and the table. And that's where she stays. So thank you. Thank you for all of your hard work. Yes. Here's to you, Virginia Leith. Go rent The Brain That Wouldn't Die. Look for it by name. Yeah. All right. With that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent brain is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. And, of course, MidwestFilmJournal.com. Evan, thanks for sharing your Godzilla information for us.
Thanks for having me on again.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!